Welcome to The Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On The Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest on this episode of The Director's Chair is the diplomat, foreign policy intellectual, and now Chancellor of the University of Queensland, Peter Varghese. Peter had a distinguished career in the Australian public service over the course of nearly four decades, representing our country abroad, running the foreign ministry and our key intelligence assessments agency, and advising a prime minister. He's a rare beast. In addition to being a highly effective bureaucrat, Peter is an original thinker and an elegant writer. So thank you, Peter Varghese, for agreeing to speak with me on The Director's Chair.
My pleasure, Michael.
Peter, let's start with your origin story, if I may. You were born in Kenya to Indian parents, one of nine children, and at the age of eight, you moved to Australia with your family. And you've described this move, I think, as providential. So tell us a bit about your background. What did your parents do for a living? Why did your family move to Australia? And how did that change your lives?
So, Michael, my family comes from Kerala in India, which is quite an unusual state because it has almost equal numbers of Hindus, Muslims, and Christians. And we're from a very old Syrian Christian community, which dates back to the time of Saint Apostle. And I used to rather haughtily tell my Christian brothers' teachers that Christianity had come to our community centuries before it came to Ireland. My parents, who were very unusual people for their time, decided soon after they got married, and they married for love, not by arrangement, which was the tradition at that time in the 40s in India. They moved to Kenya. They were both teachers. They taught for well over 20 years in Kenya. And then my father decided that the future of his kids would be brighter outside of Kenya than in Kenya. And so he, in 1964, applied to a number of countries to move, and he was offered a job in Newcastle as a high school teacher. The White Australia policy was still the official government policy. Mm-hmm. He was given a two-year visa under a special category, and he brought the entire family, nine kids, as you say, to Australia. I think it was a judgment on my parents' part that the prospects in Australia for the kids would be a lot brighter. But he knew no one in Australia. I mean, there were no family connections. I don't think my parents knew a soul in Australia. So it was a very bold move and part of a pattern of what I call family entrepreneurship by my parents, to go from India to Kenya and then from Kenya to Australia to open up new frontiers for them and certainly new frontiers for their kids.
My father was also an immigrant to Australia, and I always think that immigration is an act of imagination as well as ambition. You've got to imagine what your future might be in a country that you don't really know very well. So you started in Newcastle, but then you migrated north towards the sun. Is that how it worked?
Well, that's right, yes. So Dad was not particularly happy as a teacher in Newcastle. He'd been the headmaster of very large schools in Kenya. The culture in schools in Australia in 1964 and what he was used to in Kenya were very different. Kenya had a very hierarchical, deferential system in their schools. I think Australia was much more egalitarian. So when Dad was offered a lectureship at the University of Queensland, he jumped at the opportunity and we moved from Newcastle to Brisbane. And one of the reasons I'm so attached to the university is not just because my father worked there, but if that job offer had not been forthcoming, I think we would have left Australia a few years after we had arrived in 1964. So UQ, in a sense, was the opportunity or the gateway to our making a permanent home in Australia.
You mentioned that when your family moved to Australia, the White Australia policy or elements of it were still in place. And I guess in the wake of Black Lives Matter, we're all thinking about the history and reality of race relations in Australia. What was your experience growing up in Newcastle and then in the suburbs of Brisbane in the 1960s?
So, Michael, I might have had a relatively unusual experience for an Asian at that time, in that I can honestly say that I experienced very few instances of racial discrimination when I was growing up as a kid. And when I've reflected on this, I think they were two reasons why that might have been the case. The first was that my father, who was an educator, decided that his children should be grounded in the English language and have English as their first language. And I think that made a big difference to our ability to operate and to assimilate into Australia. And the second was because we came from a Catholic community, we had a network on arrival that we wouldn't have had before. And I think what that underlines in my mind is that Australia is a great paradox on race. If you look at the history of Australia, there is no question that race in a negative sense was a defining feature of the Australian identity. And yet if you look at individual Australians, in my experience, they are more than virtually any other community I can think of prepared to accept you at face value. So you have this baggage of racial discrimination and exclusion, but an individual pattern of behavior which is almost the opposite of it. And it's the inverse of the United States, in my experience. The United States has the baggage of ideological equality, give me your huddled masses yearning to be free. But Americans at the individual level can be very, very private and not particularly embracing of other peoples and other cultures. So my conclusion is that if you assimilate in Australia, you do very well. And I guess the obverse of that is that if you don't assimilate, you could struggle in a society which I think is still highly assimilationist.
So you graduated from UQ and then you came to the Australian Public Service. You've described yourself, I think, as an accidental public servant. How did you end up working in Canberra?
Well, it was very accidental. I mean, when I graduated in 1977, my first preference actually would have been to stay at university and to pursue an academic career. But I realised then, because I did have some pragmatism in my character, that the prospects of an academic career at that time in Australia were fairly dim. And so I applied to the public service to an administrative trainee scheme, which has since been abolished for the rather ridiculous reason that some considered it elitist, but it was elitist in the best sense of the word, in that it took the top 30 applicants to the graduate program and gave them a broader and deeper induction into the public service. So DFAT wasn't, or Foreign Affairs as then wasn't recruiting the year I joined the public service. They had a two-year freeze. And at the end of my admin trainee year, I applied to join Foreign Affairs, not because I'd had a deep and passionate interest in foreign policy. In fact, I never studied international relations at university, even though I did an arts degree. But my background obviously had made me think a lot about the world and gave me an internationalist perspective. And so I applied to Foreign Affairs, not knowing very much about public policy and foreign policy, and came to love the job and love the privilege of engaging in public policy.
And early in your career in foreign affairs, you worked as the speechwriter in the department. And in that capacity, you wrote for Foreign Minister Gareth Evans, which was a job you once likened to being a food taster for a glutton. Did you enjoy writing speeches for Gareth? What was he like to work for?
I don't know if enjoy would be the right description. So, you know, Gareth is a great structuralist, and he approaches every issue with that starting point. I think I struggled early in the period as a speechwriter because I thought I was there to write speeches which were full of cadence and nuance, and it only occurred to me a little way into the job that Gareth was thinking more of an article or a chapter of a book rather than a great oratorical, you know, expression. So, look, at one level, it's probably the hardest job I've done in that you're very alone when you're a speechwriter. You have to work to incredible deadlines. Obviously, in Gareth, you had someone who was very demanding. But in many ways, it's the job I may have learned the most from. And one thing I did get from it, Michael, is that I have never been scared of a deadline after that. Because if you've been asked to write a speech overnight, you pretty well learned to deal with the deadlines.
So a bit later in your career, Peter, you were in 2003 to 2004, you worked for John Howard when he was Prime Minister as his senior advisor for international affairs. So what was that like?
Well, I worked for John Howard in a number of capacities. I was head of the international division in Prime Minister and Cabinet when he was PM, and so worked very closely with him and travelled with him as a public servant. I had a brief stint in his office as his international advisor. And then I worked directly to John Howard when I was head of ONA. And look, I've got to say, I found John Howard a very professional person to work with as a public servant. You know, prime ministers have so many demands on their time and on their bandwidth. That to have an effective working relationship with a prime minister on foreign policy, you need a prime minister who is very disciplined in the way in which they not only do their work, but the way in which they think about the different elements of their job. And I certainly found John Howard to be someone who was enormously respectful of the public service, who listened carefully, who had his own very strong views, obviously, but who was a respecter of good process. And I think Howard's great strength as a politician was that he had a very sensible, pragmatic, but also values-based approach to a lot of policy positions. And so I think for a public servant to work with him, it was a very rewarding period. And when I was in his office, it wasn't a political job in any means, because I think the way the office was structured, the politics was done by other people, certainly more capable people than I could ever be. And so it was very much a professional foreign international and defence advisor.
One of the big issues, of course, that you had to deal with when you're in the office was Mr. Howard's most controversial foreign policy decision, and that was to participate, to take Australia into the Iraq war alongside the United States. Now, I would argue that the Iraq war made America weaker, poorer, less respected and less feared, and given that we rely on US power for our security, I think we were wrong to participate in the Iraq war. But what do you think, Peter?
Well, Michael, at the time I was a supporter of the war in Iraq. I thought that the issue of WMD was a serious issue. I don't think we went into Iraq on the basis of a lie, because many of us did believe that the evidence suggested Iraq had WMD. That was turned out to be an incorrect judgment. I think the alliance relationship was a strong factor in the thinking of the government at the moment, at the time. So while I thought at the time the action was justifiable, I'd have to say, with the benefit of hindsight, that the consequences of those of that intervention have been highly negative for the region, for Iraq, for the balance of power in the Middle East, and ultimately, I think, also for the United States. So I accept your conclusion, but I think the conclusion came later for me than when we were making that decision.
Let me ask you, you talked about Mr. Howard's professionalism as a prime minister. And of course, since he lost office in 2007, Australia has had five or six prime ministers, depending on how you count them. And I think it's not uncontroversial to say that in that period, our politics became not only less stable, but smaller. What is it that you think explains this churn of prime ministers and leaders and therefore ministers over the last decade? Why were all these very impressive individuals unable to, in the final analysis, unable to succeed in the office? What happened to Australian politics in the past decade, and do you think it's behind us?
Look, I suspect it's a very complicated process, and I think at the heart of it is the way our political system has struggled to combine policy and politics. And part of the reason, I suspect, is that the public environment now shaping and surrounding our politics has become much more intense, but also much more distorting. And I'm thinking particularly of social media here. I mean, the 24-hour news cycle has been with us for a very long time. But I do think that social media fundamentally distorts the center of gravity of any issue. And it has blunted, in my view, the antennae of political leaders. So great political leaders have very sharp political antennae, and they know where the center of gravity of an issue is, and they know how to position themselves strategically in order to achieve policy reforms. I think that skill has been diminished, and I think the static has prevented that sharpness of appreciation, which gives you a pathway to actually achieving reform. Is it over? I don't think it's over. I think we're in a period of transition in the way in which politics operates in Australia. Ultimately, because I'm both an optimist and a believer that democracies are self-correcting, I think we will end up with a political culture and a political leadership which will learn how to deliver policy reform in an environment that is more complicated now than it was in the era of Hawke or Keating or Howard. I think that will happen, but I don't think we are quite there yet.
All right. You mentioned that you worked with Mr. Howard as the Director General of the Office of National Assessments. Did you find, which was at that stage Australia's peak intelligence assessments agency, was it more fun to be a diplomat or a spook, Peter?
Well, I was never a spook, Michael. I may have headed our peak intelligence agency, but ONA didn't engage in any covert activity. Look, ONA was probably the most enjoyable job I have done in government service, and it was a remarkable privilege to be given the opportunity to work and analyse the big issues facing Australia, which you chose for yourself ultimately, with statutory independence and with a seat at all of the major tables of government when it came to foreign policy and national security issues is an enormous privilege. It's the job that I've done for the longest stint in my career. I did the ONA job for 5.5 years. I've otherwise had a highly mobile career where I've switched jobs very, very regularly. And I'm a great believer in the value of independent assessment to the quality of policymaking. You know, ONA is the only, or when I was there anyway, it was ONA. It's the only point in government which is able to call things as they see it without an investment in a policy agenda. And I think that is extraordinarily useful for policymakers who take it seriously and who are interested in knowing whether something is working or not working, or knowing more and better what the trend of international events are.
Did you agree with Prime Minister Turnbull's decision to restructure the National Intelligence Community and fold ONA into a new Office of National Intelligence?
I have a lot of reservations about that decision. I think it will ultimately weaken the assessment focus of the office. I think there's a tendency in our intelligence community to look too readily to adopt American patterns of structure that don't necessarily suit Australia. And ONI is essentially an American construct. I think if you put coordination as your primary function, you will inevitably have assessment as your secondary function. I don't think our system actually is as divided and complicated as the American system, which may require a high level of coordination. And ultimately, I think the office of ONI will get too close to the policy-making machinery of government, and that distinction between assessment and policy and not crossing the line, while it may sound obtuse to many people, is actually quite fundamental to the role of an assessment agency.
All right. After finishing up at ONA, you went to Delhi as our High Commissioner to India. Why did you request that posting, and what are your hopes for the Australia-India relationship?
Well, I had asked for Delhi quite some time before I went there. I did so because out of all of our important relationships, I thought the relationship with India had the most growth tissue left in it, and therefore I thought a High Commissioner could make more of a contribution than any other diplomatic post that I could think of. I mean, if you look at relationships like Japan, the United States, Indonesia, they are all well-developed relationships, whereas I thought with India, we were really only at the sort of early stages of building a relationship. And I remain in the long term very much of the view that the relationship with India will be a consequential one for Australia from both an economic and a geopolitical point of view, and will be buttressed now by quite an extraordinary growth in the Indian diaspora in Australia, which, you know, in a period of about a decade has gone from negligible to well over 700,000. So I think the ingredients are all there, but as always with India, this is not going to be a linear story. It's going to be a haphazard story. And so much of what we can do with India is going to depend on whether India has the capacity and the commitment and the political will to make the big reforms in the economy that it will need to give it the platform to be the major, to be a major power, which I think is where India wants to be.
Peter, what do you think the recent behaviour of the Chinese in relation to India, and in particular the border clashes between China and India, what will that do to India's posture in the world, do you think?
Well, I think it will push India closer to the United States. I think it will make India more comfortable in the Quad. I think it will probably change Indian strategic policy to this extent, that up to now, India's holy grail has been to have strategic autonomy, which has meant that all its options were constantly open. Whereas I think the intrusion across the border may well focus India's mind on the fact that sometimes exercising an option may well be very much in your national interest.
Mm. In December 2012, Peter, you were appointed Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. DFAT announced last week that it was cutting 60 jobs, and this comes after three decades of under-resourcing of Australian diplomacy and only weeks after the Morrison government announced a $270 billion spending plan on defence. If the government is so worried about Australia's strategic circumstances, is it sensible to cut our diplomatic budget even further?
Oh, I don't think it is. I mean, I think defence and diplomacy are going to be two key features of ensuring our future is brighter than it might otherwise be. And I think the funding of defence has been very important and I'm very supportive of it. I think the degrading of our diplomatic resources is a very, very short-sighted position to take. Australia needs a much more significant and a much more well-resourced diplomatic network. I mean, the Lowy Institute, I think, has spent many, many years pointing mm-hmm. to how small and under-resourced Australian diplomacy is, particularly if you look at the G20. You know, the projection of our soft power, the capacity to influence, the ability to position ourselves and to navigate a world which is going to get so much more complex and difficult for Australia. I mean, these are all things which are the front line of diplomacy. And it does worry me that we are not adequately resourcing the diplomatic corps. And to go backwards, I think, is a great shame.
Tell me this, how has the coronavirus pandemic changed Australia's foreign relations, do you think?
Look, I think ultimately the coronavirus accelerates rather than creates change. And we're going to see that, I think, in the medium term. I think the biggest consequence of the coronavirus is the induced global recession that mm-hmm. it is creating. And that will have its own internal as well as geopolitical consequences. I think it's accelerated trends that we could see beforehand. I think the push for a measure of deglobalization is something that we're going to have to deal with. I think the siren call for self-sufficiency. In many ways, Michael, we're going to have to re-prosecute the case for an open economy. And that's going to be challenging for our political leaders. I think we will see an inward-lookingness in many countries. I think there are real questions as to whether China is misreading whether the coronavirus has created a window of opportunity for it. And you can perhaps see that in its behavior over the last few months, where it seems to be taking on quarrels across many, many fronts. So, you know, this is something which will have very large consequences, but not all of them are created by the coronavirus. Many of them, I think, were there just under the surface and are being accentuated.
It has definitely sharpened the terms of Australia's relationship with China, in part because of the government's call for an independent international investigation into the origins of the pandemic, which the Chinese didn't appreciate. You've been writing recently about with a framework of your own about how Australia should approach China, arguing we should both engage and constrain Beijing. Can you tell us a bit about that view?
So, Michael, I think what's happened with the relationship with China, and this doesn't just apply to Australia, is that we have strayed from engagement, but we haven't really worked out what should replace it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's realistic anymore to have a policy which is just hope for the best engagement with China. But I also very strongly have the view that a containment policy in the way that we have understood that in the days of the Soviet Union would be a policy disaster, not just for Australia, but for international relations more broadly. So I think we do need to engage with China. I mean, that's just a common sense observation. Mm-hmm. The fact is we do have strong mutual interests, whether they're bilateral economic interests or whether they're multilateral interests, because there are many global problems that are going to need global solutions, and China will have to be part of that. But it is also the case that simple engagement will not address the tensions that arise from China's strategic ambition to be the predominant power in our region. And so we do need a mechanism or a structure or what I would call a new strategic equilibrium, which creates space for a measure of collective pushback when China behaves in ways which are unacceptable or clearly in violation of international law or international principles. And I see the core of that collective pushback being built around the so-called Quad, the US, Japan, Australia and India, and other countries may well also wish to join it. But we need to get to the point where leverage vis-a-vis China is a two-way street, not a one-way street. I think it's next to impossible for countries unilaterally to resist Chinese pressure or Chinese coercion, with the possible exception of the United States. And in the end, I think our public discussion of China has been far too distracted by this debate about whether the US or the China will ultimately mm-hmm. prevail as the strongest power. One thing I know for sure is that China cannot be stronger than the aggregate weight of the US, Japan, India, Australia, plus other countries, whether it's Indonesia or South Korea, that may ultimately want to create this new strategic equilibrium. So I think that's a more sensible starting point than what we've seen elsewhere. And I think there is a real risk that if we don't try and find a sensible, workable path, we will be pulled to the extremes in our China policy, of which a full-throated containment policy would be the worst of it.
You say that Australia can't behave unilaterally towards China, and I don't think we are, but it probably is true that we are out in front of a lot of our partners at the moment on many issues, whether it's Huawei or the pandemic investigation or even Hong Kong, certainly out in front of most Asian partners. How would you assess the Morrison government's approach to China at the moment?
Look, I think the government has tried to manage the relationship as best it could. I think there has been a certain lack of discipline in terms of what members of the government who are not in the ministry say about China, which I don't think has been helpful. I don't think Australia has consciously set out to lead the world on issues like Huawei or even an inquiry into COVID. But clearly we have been an early mover in those areas mm-hmm. in a way which I think has irritated China enormously. Now, I think there's sometimes a tendency in the Australian public commentary to ascribe blame to the Australian government if the relationship mm-hmm. is in a bad shape. I don't think there's anything that the Australian government has done. You can argue about the nuance or a word here or there, or you can argue about timing. But I don't think this is a relationship which has reached a low point entirely because of the Australian government. I mean, at the end of the day, our policy positions in many of these areas are responding to positions that China has taken. And I think, you know, we do need to look at those through the prism of our national interests. But we do also need to recognize that we have to have a relationship with China, and it is finding how best to manage that relationship and what is the best conceptual framework for it, which I think is our big challenge. And it goes back to what we've just been discussing about a path between hope for the best engagement and containment.
All right. Having asked you a lot about China, let me ask you one question about the United States. I think most of the world is hoping that the United States course corrects in November and sends Mr. Trump back to Trump Tower. If that happens, how much damage will the Trump presidency have done to the United States? Can America snap back? What long-term posture would you expect from Washington, even if they vote in Mr. Biden in November?
Yeah, look, I think the world can survive 4 years of Donald Trump. I would be much less confident that the world can survive 8 years of Donald Trump. So let's see what the American people decide. What sits behind Trump's election is not just a manifestation of Donald Trump. What sits behind Donald Trump's election in his first term are some much more significant drivers of American culture and American society. I mean, America is in some ways going through a socio-psychological catharsis of which Trump is a manifestation. Can America snap back? Well, America has this remarkable historical ability to rejuvenate and regenerate, and I think we write that off at our peril, but we will not see a Biden presidency, if that's what we end up with, picking up where the Obama presidency left off. And many features of the Trump administration's policy with which Australia is less than comfortable, I think a number of those features will probably continue to drive American policy. But I think we will see a more multilateral United States administration under Biden. And for a country that can't buy or bully its way in the world like Australia, that will be a plus. I think we will see more sensible and considered alliance management under a Biden administration than we've seen under the Trump administration. While I don't expect a Biden administration to be a great champion of trade liberalization, I don't think it'll be quite as mercantilist in its trade policy as we've seen so far in the United States. So it'll be a mixed picture if we do in fact see a change of president in November.
Well, let's hope you're right and America is going through a catharsis rather than a breakdown, which is the other term one could think about. Let me finish, Peter, by asking you a question that I've put to all my guests on the director's chair. What have you liked about lockdown? Obviously, you're probably spending more time in your apartment, less time in the bucolic quadrangles of UQ at St. Lucia, but what have you enjoyed about this period?
Well, we've been very lucky with the lockdown because, you know, we can work comfortably from home and we've spent a lot of time also at the beach. So like many other people, I mean, I've enjoyed having more time available to do things that are more interesting perhaps than other things that we do, reading more, listening to podcasts, which is not something I do all that often, but I've started to do it, even watching sort of discussions and seminars on YouTube, which again is not something I've traditionally done. I think I'm probably living a more healthy lifestyle. I go for many more walks, which means I can listen to many more things on podcasts. I've enjoyed not commuting, having had a program which used to take me to Sydney virtually every week. The productivity gain in not having to commute is very extensive. I found working virtually very productive in that you get down to the discussion straight away and people stick to their time limit. But I have also discovered, Michael, that I'm less of an introvert than I thought I was. And so the restrictions of COVID in terms of getting out and catching up with friends and family and going out to meals and so on have been less appealing. But overall, I've got to say I've had a good lockdown.
Well, I'm glad that you've discovered podcasts, not only listening to them but appearing on them. So thank you, Peter Varghese, for being extroverted with us today. Thank you for being my guest on The Director's Chair.
My pleasure, Michael. All the best.
You've been listening to The Director's Chair, a podcast by the Lowy Institute, hosted by me, Michael Fullilove, with production assistance from Madeline Neist. Thanks for listening, and please tune in to the next episode of The Director's Chair.